UST. Together, we build for boundless impact.
The U.S. and China dial back their rancor at a summit between President Biden and Xi Jinping. Plus, the Senate backs a short-term spending bill, even as larger debates loom. And Israel cites evidence of Hamas activity at Gaza's largest hospital.
It's just extremely high stakes on what exactly is found at this hospital, what it proves, and whose narrative it helps.
It's Thursday, November 16th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. President Biden and China's Xi Jinping have wrapped up a closely watched summit in California, with Biden saying that several hours of meetings were, quote, some of the most constructive and productive discussions we've had. But the reset in relations is likely to be quickly tested by deep underlying frictions. And when asked by a reporter if he trusts Xi, here's what Biden had to say.
Do I trust you? I trust but verify, as that old saying goes. That's where I am. And, we're in a competitive relationship, China and the United States. But my responsibility is to make this rational and manageable. So it doesn't result in conflict.
Joining me now to discuss the difficulties of actually making the U.S.-China relationship manageable is Journal senior correspondent Brian Spiegel in Beijing. Brian, we heard Biden there resorting to words made famous by President Reagan in the Cold War as he tries to manage ties with China. Maybe that's telling. You're in China. How has the summit gone over there?
Yeah, I think in general, the feeling in China, or at least how it's being portrayed in the state media here, is that this was a very productive meeting between Xi and Biden. From a domestic agenda, this meeting was very important. Xi wanted to present himself to the Chinese public as a positive, as a responsible steward of China's relationship with the United States. Obviously, that relationship has been really severely challenged recently. There's a lot of people asking questions in China. Why are we going down such a bad road with one of our largest trading partners? More than $700 billion per year in trade happens between these countries, and many Chinese want a stable, productive relationship with the United States. And I think for a domestic audience, Xi really wanted to show that he's got this under control.
Let's talk about some of the tangible things that were agreed on yesterday, starting with the restoration of military-to-military communications. How much can that actually serve to de-escalate tensions when there are still so many underlying stressors from Taiwan to the South China Sea that remain?
Yes, that's correct. So a little bit of context. This has been something that the United States in particular has been pushing for quite some time. As you know, the militaries of the United States and China are operating in close vicinity to each other in the Taiwan Strait, in the South China Sea, and elsewhere. And the United States' fear is that some sort of mishap, accident, if not handled appropriately, could escalate. And so they've been pushing China for quite some time to reopen some of these stalled communication channels. Earlier this year, it was very clear that the view from Beijing was, we don't believe in communicating for the sake of communication. And what's interesting is to watch, there clearly seems to be a shift from China right now. But in the event of a real crisis, it remains to be seen, do those channels work? That's one of the things that Biden really wanted to stress to Xi is, will you pick up the phone if there is a crisis? Can we get that guarantee from you that we do have that level of trust, that we can talk to each other to manage any potential crisis?
Another thing agreed to was to cooperate on choking off fentanyl production. This is the opioid that has been ravaging the U.S., something Biden underscored last night. Could this agreement do much to address that, especially considering these countries had agreed to work on combating trafficking before, only to let talks languish?
This is something that the United States specifically has been pushing for very hard. As we know, China is sending significant amounts of so-called precursor chemicals, the chemicals that go into actually making the fentanyl. Mexican cartels are buying those chemicals from China and then sending the fentanyl into the United States. So the United States has gone to China and said, look, work with us. Stop sending those chemicals to Mexico, and that'll go a long way to smoothing out our relationship. So China's agreed to reopen this channel. It's really not clear yet how serious they are about cracking down on these precursor chemical producers. I think we're going to get a good sense of that over the coming weeks, whether we start to see arrests in China, whether we see some of these products disappearing from the gray marketplace online that they kind of operate in. But as you say, this is not a breakthrough in the sense that this is completely new. Really, the better way to think about this is we're returning the relationship to some level of normalcy, back to a more stable place where on real substantive issues, they hope to be able to communicate.
And finally, on the topic of economic cooperation, Xi said that he rejects the idea of, quote, major country competition, end quote. Though, pick up the journal on any given day and you may well find fresh evidence of just how strained U.S.-China economic relations are. You know, export restrictions, tit-for-tat measures have become so common here. What is the likelihood of actually ratcheting down those tensions, breaking that cycle maybe?
So what we've seen from the United States side on this is they've listened very hard to what China's had to say about, for example, the United States bans or restrictions on sending semiconductors for artificial intelligence to China. That's really one of the key issues that we're talking about, the tools that are needed to build the future of economies in both countries. So when we had Secretary Yellen here earlier this year, she made the point very clearly that these sorts of restrictions, on one hand, they're non-negotiable. If they're issues of national security, however, they should be very narrowly targeted, right? And I think that sort of language leaves open some space. So what will be really interesting to watch is now at the working level, whether the United States is willing to make some concessions to China to narrow the scope of some of these restrictions on economic cooperation. But we have to remember, there's a lot of political considerations as well. Both parties of Congress actually really have eagle eyes on these sorts of issues. And don't forget, we're going into a presidential election year as well. So there's going to be even narrower space for U.S.-China cooperation going forward later this year.
I have been speaking to Journal senior correspondent Brian Spiegel in Beijing. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And before we move on, let's get a very quick update on how markets are reacting to the Xi-Biden summit. Given that U.S.-China tensions have at times left businesses caught in the middle, I asked our deputy Europe finance editor, Quinton Webb, if we'd seen any response to the two countries trying to make their relations more stable and productive.
It's hard to say that we have seen a strong immediate market reaction. Investors would rather see the leaders of the world's two largest economies in dialogue than not. But there's no concrete progress here, for instance, on trade, which is one of the key issues. On the executive side, there's a long-standing complaint about market access. And more recently, heavy national security focus within China has come into view. And then on the investor side, the Chinese economy has decelerated. There's still these very significant problems with the property sector. Consumer confidence seems to be rather weak. Those problems are not addressed by a single summit with the US either. So not a kind of clear buy signal for any major asset or asset class.
That was our deputy Europe finance editor, Quinton Webb. Coming up, we'll get the latest on Israeli operations at Gaza's largest hospital. And we'll head to Washington, where a spending bill to avoid a government shutdown is heading to President Biden's desk. We've got those stories and more after the break.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Let's turn to Gaza now and to the enclave's largest hospital. This time yesterday, we reported that Israeli forces were engaged in operations at the Al-Shifa hospital complex, an event that cast into sharp focus the complexities of combat in a densely populated urban area. Journal correspondent Chow Deng has been covering the situation at Al-Shifa and how it feeds into the dueling narratives about the war around the world. Chow, give us the very latest, if you could. What is the status of those Israeli operations at Al-Shifa?
So as far as we know, the Israeli military is still there and continuing to search various buildings on the campus, which is quite large. In the first 24 hours, they went into several buildings, including the MRI wing, and they showed a video of what they found there, from some weapons to a laptop to military uniforms and one battle vest that had the insignia of Hamas's military wing. So we're expecting the Israeli side to release some more information about their operations in the coming days.
We should note just how contentious this operation has been, Chow, happening at a medical facility in the midst of a conflict with a lot on the line for Israel, for Hamas, for the U.S. even, in determining whether this hospital was in fact being used by Hamas or other armed groups. Tell us more about how all of that has been playing out.
So when Israel went inside the hospital, the stakes became much higher for everyone involved in the conflict. Obviously, Israel, because it has said that Shifa is the beating heart of Hamas's operation. International law is supposed to protect hospitals. Hospitals can lose protection if they are found to have militant activity inside. And so the stakes are pretty high for Israel to be able to prove this point. There are stakes for Hamas, obviously, because it says that it doesn't operate from hospitals and has accused Israel of being the one endangering thousands of people inside Shifa. And there are also stakes for the U.S., which a few hours before Israel went into the hospital, the U.S. said it had its own intelligence that there were militants operating inside. So it's just extremely high stakes on what exactly is found at this hospital, what it proves, and whose narrative it helps.
Chow, finally, what is next beyond Al-Shifa? What could be in the cards for Gaza from here on out?
Just today, Israel said that it struck one of the residences of the Hamas political chief. So we can expect Israel to continue trying to pursue Hamas members and leadership. And then secondly, there's an expectation on the ground that Israel may expand its operations in the south. There was one southern town called Khan Yunis that received leaflets telling residents there to evacuate. And so there's fear in the south, where a lot of people are crowded, that Israel might continue to carry out airstrikes and potentially more in the coming days and weeks.
That was Journal correspondent Chow Deng. Chow, thank you.
Thanks.
The U.S. Senate has approved a short-term spending bill to avoid a looming government shutdown. In passing a stopgap spending bill last night, the chamber postponed debate on specific government programs and budgets until next year, though the bipartisan piece likely won't last that long ahead of a series of funding deadlines in January and February. The bill now goes to President Biden for his signature. The prosecutor investigating why classified documents ended up at President Biden's home and former office is preparing a sharply critical report on how Biden and his longtime aides handled the material, though sources said the probe isn't likely to result in a criminal case. Special Counsel Robert Hur, who's led the investigation since January, has interviewed roughly 100 of Biden's aides, colleagues, and family members, including his son Hunter, culminating in a two-day interview with the president last month. Hur is expected to release the report in the next couple of months and potentially before the end of the year. Representatives for Hur, the White House, and Hunter Biden, as well as President Biden's legal team, declined to comment or didn't respond to requests for comment. And finally, the world's biggest food importer, China, spends more than $200 billion a year on foreign produce due to its vast population and its limited arable land, an economic force that's capable of boosting economies and reshaping agricultural communities. In a vivid illustration of that, Journal reporter John Emont recently traveled to central Vietnam, where coffee growers are uprooting their trees in order to cultivate durian, a popular fruit in China.
There was one place I passed where it was this huge lot that had used to be there for drying coffee. Now it was being turned into a warehouse for durian, a spiky fruit with custardy innards. And when you go to the farmers' houses, you see they're getting wealthier. They're earning a lot of money from this fruit. Some of them looked like little humble farmers' cottages, but they were building marble facades on them. Some of them were adding these fancy new irrigation systems. Just felt like there was a durian gold rush. They were cashing in.
But amidst the excitement, John told us there are concerns that changing food trends could hurt Chinese demand, or that farmers could end up on the wrong side of import restrictions.
We've seen this a lot in recent years. From Australian lobsters have gotten cut up in this. Australian red wine has gotten cut up in this. Philippines bananas has gotten cut up in this. Taiwanese pineapples has gotten cut up in this. Vietnam has a pretty good relationship with China, but they've also got some issues in the South China Sea that are unresolved. Vietnam's also getting closer to the United States. So there are potential friction points. And one relatively easy way for China to exert pressure is just to make it more difficult to export. It's a useful way to signal to a government, hey, you know, we're not happy.
And it's worth noting that China has usually cited contamination, pests, or issues with quality when it's moved to restrict imports recently, but that the curbs have also often coincided with political disputes. And that is What's News for Thursday morning. Today's show was produced by Mohsen Ali and Kate Bullivant. Our supervising producer was Christina Rocha, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. And until then, thanks for listening.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/itheroes.